felled by the financial crisis, acquired by Wells Fargo in December. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
China has executed two members of the Uyghur Muslim minority. The two men were convicted of staging a brazen attack on police last August, 4 days before the start of the Beijing Olympic Games. China says 17 people died in the attack. What's believed to be the first Passover Seder hosted and attended by a U.S. president at the White House is to take place this evening. President Obama has invited a group of close friends and staff to the private White House meal, an overt reflection of the president's promise that Jewish voters would have an ally with him in office. The White House says the Seder meal will be traditional, including matzah, bitter herbs, a roasted egg, and greens. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
Life's a journey. Take someone with you.
Hi there, I'm Noah Adams.
This is Lisa Mullins.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
This is AM 580 News Director Tom Rogers.
I'm Leanne Hansen.
You depend on us for programs that help you navigate life, and we depend on you for financial support that makes them possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to join you in supporting WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Support for programs on WILL comes from the Beckman Institute on the U of I campus. The Beckman Institute 20th anniversary celebration will be held on Thursday, April 16th, beginning at 3 p.m. in the Beckman Institute auditorium. The celebration is open to the public.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will be spending some time talking about Russia. About Russia today, about its economy, about commercial relations between Russia and the United States. Try to talk a little bit about how Russia has been affected by the economic downturn that countries all over the world are having to deal with. And we have here as our guest someone who has been thinking about and following these kind of issues for quite a long time, Eugene Lawson. He is past president of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. He also, before that, spent time as acting chairman, president, and also vice chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. He has had a number of posts in government. He served as deputy undersecretary of labor for international affairs. He was ambassador to the International Labor Organization in Geneva, deputy assistant secretary of commerce for East Asia and the Pacific, deputy assistant secretary of commerce for East-West Trade, which was particularly concerned with trade with the former Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries. He's also been an academic. He's been a lecturer at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And he is on the campus to take part in a conference that's sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. The conference is Reform or Retrenchment, Post-Communist Eurasia, and the World Economic Crisis. And he'll be talking this afternoon. He'll be giving, in fact, the keynote address, Russia, Friend or Foe. That's this afternoon at 3:15. So I think that anybody who is in and around Champaign-Urbana who is interested should feel that they would be welcome to attend and hear what he has to say. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome, too. The number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask people who are calling in is that people try to keep their comments, questions brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, listeners are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being
here. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Appreciate it. One just general place to start would be to talk about Russia and how it has been affected by the downturn in the world economy, and certainly it has, and perhaps more seriously than some other places. Certainly one of the things that I'm sure that they are struggling with has been the decline in the price of oil, since that was really at the root, energy was really at the root of the boom in recent years in the Russian economy. So how is the Russian economy doing today?
Not as good as it was a few months ago, that's for sure. You know, it might be useful to do just a quick review of where it was. Mm-hmm. For instance, take as a baseline 1998, when Russia had devalued and defaulted on its internal loan. Its economy in 1998 was the size of Los Angeles County. And 10 years later, it became the sixth largest economy in the world. I'm sorry, the sixth largest, some people would say seventh largest economy in the world. This is phenomenal growth, absolutely phenomenal growth, driven in part by the price of commodities, but also in part because Putin got a handle and made Russia a stable country and got it organized and got on the right track and passed some very, very much needed reforms in 2002 to 2003. And it grew enormously. It grew enormously. It was really, I think, in the eyes of many, many economists, kind of a textbook case of how you grow an economy. And as I say, it was not just fueled, pardon the pun, by the price of crude oil and natural gas. So here we come up the present time, and the Russians, as late as, February of 2008, Mr. Kudrin, the finance minister, was saying, Russia is not going to be touched by this disaster that's overtaking the West here. I mean, we're totally, totally decoupled from that. We have $600 billion of reserves. We have $200 billion in a rainy day fund. The price of crude is $147 a barrel. We are flying high. And they were acting like it, too. I mean, they were pushing their weight around and doing some things we don't like them to do, like for them to do. Then came the reality, and they quickly realized that instead of being decoupled, they were really affected by the downturn quickly became, politically speaking, a little more accommodating to the Western point of view. Mm-hmm. Their unemployment went from 5.5 to 8.5. From July, it was 5.5, and in just a few months, it went to 8.5. Its foreign exchange actually fell by about a third. What else? I mean, the price of crude, which was the main driver of the whole thing, of course, which, as you pointed out before in your introductory remarks, price of crude fell from $147 a barrel in the summer to something like 40, 40 or 50. And this had a devastating effect on the amount of foreign exchange it had. The foreign exchange fell, as I said, by a third, and unemployment went way up. And more important than that, though, was the fact that people all of a sudden felt less confident because some of the Russian banks fell. And there's a history in recent Russian society of Russian bank system failure as a system and individual banks falling and people losing their money. So when that started to happen, the confidence really ebbed out of that new middle class that Russia had developed over 10 years. 25% of the Russian population is in the middle class, but that middle class was really hit. So of all the emerging countries, Russia was the hardest hit. So right now, Russia is struggling, as we all are, to get its footing.
Hmm. Well, given that, as you say, that the Russians have actually so far had to burn up a lot of their cash reserves, right. Russian stock market, I think, lost something like, 70% of
80%.
I'm behind.
That was that statistic that I was searching for in my little pea brain.
80% of its value, a great deal of loss of confidence. A number of countries here in the United States, what we've done is try to put money into the financial sector in the hope that we can keep everybody afloat and things will turn around. Britain has taken the same approach. Other countries in Western Europe, not so sure how they feel about that. The Germans don't think that that's such
a
great idea.
And the French don't either.
The French don't either. What are the Russians – what sort of policy have the Russians taken? What can they – what do they have the reserves to do? And then what is their sort of mindset on this? What do they think the thing is to do?
It's so closely tied to the price of crude, and crude has actually gone up in the last few months a little bit here to enable them to do more and to be more protectionist and put more of a stimulus package together. Their model is somewhere in between the French and Germans and the U.S. and U.K. They're putting some money in to stabilize the banking system, which they desperately need to do. Otherwise, they're not jacking up what the oligarchs want them to do. The oligarchs have been badly hit because they've been over-leveraged. And they're coming to the state and saying, please bail us out. And the state is saying, no, not today. Maybe tomorrow, but not today. And that may or may not be all bad, but what it means is that it's a strategy somewhere, somewhere in between. And I think they're probably doing it about as best as they can do. The fact of the matter is, David, as you well know, we don't know how to deal with this thing. This is something new and different. You know, we're on completely uncharted territory, both in Western Europe, around the globe. I mean, the Indians and the Chinese, the same way, people in Brazil, the same way. We don't really know how to respond to this global recession right now. It's set off by the collapse of the financial institutions.
Yeah. But maybe back to economic matters in a moment, but let me ask a political question or questions about the political relationship between the U.S. and Russia. Certainly during the Bush administration, the relationship was about as tense as it had been maybe since the end of the Cold War. Certainly the rhetoric had gotten to a very high level on both sides. So now we have a new administration and an opportunity to start, to the extent that you can, to start again. And certainly the kind of comments that were coming out of the G20 meeting in London, Mr. Medvedev and President Obama sat down and everybody was smiling and everybody said, this is great. Now here we have an opportunity to make a new start. I was also interested, though, to learn at virtually the same time or slightly before that, we had comments from General John Craddock, who is the top commander of NATO, essentially saying that, making reference to the Russian invasion of Georgia last summer, saying, well, at the end of the Cold War, we were kind of talking like Russia wasn't a threat anymore. Well, we were mistaken. Now, how do you have the General Craddock, talking about Russia still being a threat to Europe, at the same time as you have Mr. Obama and Mr. Medvedev smiling, shaking hands, and saying it's a new beginning for relations between Russia and the U.S.?
Good question, David. It's a little bit of a disconnect here between a senior officer there in the Pentagon and the White House and so forth, and we need to get on the same page and have, I think, a more consistent answer. Let me start by saying that you're exactly right. At the end of the Bush administration, the language couldn't have been more acrimonious. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were making fun of them, and we were saying a lot of nasty statements about the Russians, and they reciprocated in kind, to be sure. They started off really and said a lot of nasty things about us and so forth, and we were at wit's end, to be sure. Something happened at the very end of the Bush administration that hasn't gotten very much attention, and that is the Sochi Declaration, where Bush and Putin got together for a day and a half in their staffs and wrote out a document that really, I think, draws upon the past and set a good roadmap. It was a blueprint here for developing future relations based on the fact that, look, regardless of who wins the election a few months later, both countries agree that we have big areas of commonality. We need the Russians to get our troops in Afghanistan. We need them to help us on Iran and North Korea. We need them in so many ways. And they need us in so many ways, too. And so here is a roadmap. And they published this thing, I guess it was in the fall, is that right? It was late summer, early fall. And so the thinking was that, regardless of who came in, that this might serve as a blueprint. That's actually been the case. Mr. Obama mentioned it at the G20 news conference here, that a lot of the actions that are going to be taken now in the future are going to be based on Sochi. Sochi will be actually implemented here. Because I think having a new administration come in presents a golden opportunity for a new start. Let's just end this talk about a new Cold War. It's absurd. We need each other. Let's start talking not about the past, not about Kosovo and all the things that we disagreed on here, but let's talk about what we can do in the future to align our two countries together on major crucial foreign policy issues that really surmount the differences that we have on X, Y, and Z. And I've heard directly from someone who was there at the Obama Medvedev summit, at the G20 summit, that the chemistry was excellent. They actually avoided kind of smiling a lot at each other because they wanted to get away from the personal relationship kinds of mode that Mr. Bush had set us in with his famous remark that he looked at Mr. Putin deep into his eyes and saw and read his heart and so on and so on. But I do see developing a new beginning in the relationship here. Shortly after the G20, Secretary Clinton sat down with poor Mr. Lavrov, and they had a long discussion. Mr. Lavrov loved to talk, and maybe Secretary Clinton does too. I don't know, but whatever it was, they spent a great deal of time talking to each other here. And I think it started really a month ago with Mr. Biden's speech with her in Munich, where he said, "Hey, I'm punching the restart button on this relationship here," and that alerted everybody to the fact that let's try it again. So I'm very, very happy. Secondly, I would make the point that, you know, crude is not 147. Crude's 50 or 60 or 70, going, you know, in the right direction for the Russians anyway. But it means, though, that the Russians are a little bit easier to deal with. They know how much they need us in commercial economic investment matters. And so that makes them a little bit easier to deal with in the new administration. And it seems to me, David, it's starting to come together here. There's already been a pullback a little bit of missiles, you know, in Poland and radar sites in Czechoslovakia and so forth. And that was really a bone, a chicken bone in the throat of Russians everywhere, you know, that kind of thing, because they didn't see that as against Iran. They saw it as against them. So I'm kind of cautiously optimistic, I must say.
We are talking this morning in this hour, Focus 580, with Eugene Lawson. He's the founder, past president of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, has also had leadership posts at the Export-Import Bank of the U.S., and also has worked in the Department of Labor. He was Deputy Undersecretary of Labor for International Affairs. He served also as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for East Asia and the Pacific, and is here visiting the campus to take part in a conference on Russia, talking about Russia today, and I'm sure talking about the relationship between Russia and the United States. And here this morning, that we're talking about those things, as well as business commercial relations between the two countries. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller up in the northwestern part of the state, up in the Belvedere area, and we'll go right there. Mm-hmm. Line 4, hello.
Yes, good morning. Good subject. Yeah, you were right about a couple of things. The only subject I don't know if you studied this or not or have seen this in USA Today, and I think Wall Street Journal came out with this, that the Russians are selling a lot of their military equipment off, and nobody seems to know where it's going. Because of the financial crisis, that seems like they're really they're willing to wheel and deal with it, just about anything. And I do kind of question some of the new administration's ideas on how to deal with these people. To be honest with you, I think them and China are the two worst ones. And we're talking about not having a Cold War, but we actually have a Cold War going on, so to speak. The Russians do have planes flying around the world now like they did in the 60s and the 70s. There's not much publicity about it, but it's a fact now that it was out a couple, I think it was like last year they brought out. The other thing is, too, they have, partial ownership or big chunk ownership in the space station. And I personally think I'm dead set against it because they have a lot of failures, and I think you're going to find out the Americans going to end up paying for a lot of their mistakes, the way things are going with the Russians right now, I'm very skeptical if you can trust them on anything. And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, you can reflect on that any way you like. Particularly, I suppose the issue might be Russia would see export of military equipment as being one avenue of generating some cash.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would want to come back to you, if I may, if you have both hands on the wheel and you're driving into Chicago or whatever you are. But can you tell me any scenario in which the U.S. might be paying for Russia's mistakes?
Well, the caller rang off, so I'm not sure whether.
Okay.
I don't know if he was thinking about this sort of partnership we have with doing things in space or what.
In space, you know, it's interesting. We learned from the Russians in space in many respects. Mm. I mean, even when they had Soyuz, which was held together with glue and scotch tape, I mean, I talked to the head of NASA. He said, you know, the line of U.S. astronauts that went around on Soyuz goes from here to the Pentagon. You know, he said they have gotten to things that we are not even thinking about right now. And we benefit mightily from that, and they saved our duff there all the time when we couldn't get a shuttle up there, and we had to get some help up there to the Hubble telescope and to do some other things there in the space station that wouldn't survive, that wouldn't upon the survival of the space station, and they came to our rescue. So I in that regard, the space cooperation is a major pillar, really, of the relationship between the U.S. and Russia. Now, you're absolutely correct on one matter. The Russians, in order to earn foreign exchange, as David suggested, and for other reasons, are in the process of going around the world picking out people who are mad at the U.S. And in South America, it's Venezuela and Bolivia and Nicaragua. And they get hard cash for it and so forth. And they also poke us in the eye. You know, when they first started doing that, I mean, the State Department said, gee, we're surprised that there was even a Russian ship or a Russian plane that could fly that far. They ridiculed the whole thing. There's probably a little bit less of that right now than there was at the outset. But the sales are reasonably modest. I mean, there's no question that they're playing mischief down there in South America as a way. I see it as a way to get our attention, not as any big strategic threat against the U.S., because it doesn't exist, to be sure. Venezuela actually was not a problem, of course, that the Russians had anything to do with. That was strictly between us and the Venezuelans, and Mr. Chavez is taking advantage of that and turning to the person who would help him stand up to the Americans, and that's the Russians. But I don't see that as any strategic threat. I do see that as an effort by Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev, that, you know, America, listen to us. You know, our views have not been reflected that well in the last 18 years. You promised us that you wouldn't have NATO come right up to our borders. You didn't do that. NATO is at our borders, you know, and you're actively, you know, considering whether or not the Ukraine and Georgia are going to be members of NATO. You know, you said that you wouldn't interfere in Kosovo, and you did interfere in Kosovo in a big, giant way. You know, you haven't kept your word on many things. And by the way, we were the first country to call you after 9/11, and we don't feel like we've gotten much benefit from that. Yeah. You know, so there's a lot that the Russians feel that's going on that's not fair.
Well, thinking about what was going on just right at the point where the Cold War was officially declared to be over, there was a lot of triumphalism going around, and I think that a lot of people actually said, they came out and said, well, Russia doesn't matter anymore. We don't have to worry about Russia. We don't have to deal with Russia. And I'm sure that the Russians saw themselves as the once and future empire that they were, and clearly were insulted. Their pride was wounded, and indeed it might have been a true mistake to simply dismiss Russia. And that perhaps some of the difficulty in the relationship that we have had comes from that, and the Russians feeling that indeed they would not be dismissed in that way. Was that a mistake?
Yeah, it was a terrible mistake, I think, on the part of the Bush administration, and also I might add on the part of the Clinton administration too, because in the second term of the Clinton administration, the Russians were dissed. They were simply dismissed. They weren't even on the radar scope, to be sure. And after the first term of George W. Bush's administration, the second term, you know, again like the Clinton administration, they weren't fully appreciated here. The Russians have a case to make. They really do. I mean, their basic case is that you all are treating us like a defeated enemy in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. We don't like to be treated that way. You know, we did more than you did to bring to an end the Soviet regime. And it's our victory. And we're all gaining from this. And it's a good thing that we're, you know, a new Russian, we all like that, and so on and so on here. But give us some credit for this, and don't treat us like a defeated enemy. And we did. I mean, we were, as you say, David, so well here that we kind of said to everybody, hey, we're number one. And Mr. Bush, I think, strutted around the globe in many respects and gave that impression, whether he meant to or not. It came across that way, especially in Russia.
We are at our midpoint here. Again, let me just very quickly introduce our guest, Eugene Lawson. He is the founder, has served also served for a number of years as president of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. He had a number of posts at the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. And also in the Department of Labor and Commerce. And he's here visiting the campus to take part in a conference sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. The topic is Reform or Retrenchment, Post-Communist Eurasia and World Economic Crisis. That's happening today on the campus. And he will be giving the keynote address, Russia Friend or Foe. That's this afternoon at 3:15. And this is taking place on the U of I campus in the Illini Union. And I believe that anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could shift to a little different subject and ask you to put on your old hat as the head of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. I think that a lot of people at the end of the Cold War also felt that this would be there would be opportunities here for U.S., for the United States and U.S. businesses to do business in Russia. Mm-hmm. And that overall, I think that I think some people would say that to date, trade between the U.S. and Russia has been pretty disappointing. Mm-hmm. I think that I read that Russia is the 30th largest market for U.S. products. That's pretty far down the list. I'm sure that there are a number of reasons, a number of ways to explain that, concerns about security in Russia and whether we really have a market firmly in place and whether we have rule of law and so forth and so on. How would you, though, how would you answer that question? Why is it that the potential simply hasn't been realized?
That's an awful question, David. I would point out one thing that we have had some major successes in Russia in the trade, investment, economic field. Trade, bilateral trade between our two countries has grown from $7 billion in 2003 to $31 billion this year, which is not bad. It's not bad growth at all. Frankly, it ought to be a lot more. I mean, two-way trade is slightly better than Costa Rica and the U.S., as you point out. They're at 30th. I mean, Russia does not come in very good. That ought to be at least double, if not triple. And there are lots and lots and lots of reasons for that here. First of all, and I may surprise you when I say this here, but, you know, the U.S. obviously is a newcomer to Russia. The Europeans have been doing business with Russia for maybe 1,000 years or so, and we're strictly Johnny come lately here. And we have a lot to learn, and we made a lot of mistakes in trying to do business there and so forth. You know, in many respects, U.S. firms that first started to try the market, you know, in 1993, 1994, even before that, really hadn't done much exporting. They saw a collapse there. They thought they could kind of come in and do some deals. They didn't send their A team in there. Many companies nowadays will actually admit that they didn't send their A team in originally. It was chaotic when the Soviet Union fell and Russia became the Russian Federation in 1993. And it was very, very difficult to cut a deal in Russia at that time if you're an American firm. Don't forget that. I mean, we are much more legalistic than the Europeans are. The Europeans are inclined to have a handshake and maybe a short little piece of paper here denoting the contract. American firms are not. Are not. They like to go into the details. And at that point, there wasn't any real law that you could hang your hat on. There was the demise and the carryover of the Soviet law and the implementation of the start, I should say, of an attempt by the Russian new law to sort of marry itself to Western law. And it was all chaos. And that took us back a bit, to be sure. But I think one of the major things was that the Europeans were there before us, and they weren't helpful to the Americans coming in. yeah, you know, if you want to put it that way. And also, we couldn't play the same game that they played, because corruption has grown in Russia from the beginning of the Russian Federation to the time to right now. 18 years ago, it seems like a long time ago, doesn't it, when Soviet Union became the Russian Federation. But we can't play the same game. I don't want to go into excruciating detail about it here, but all of our listeners, I think, can surmise what I'm talking about, is that the Europeans have a lot more latitude and leeway in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act than we do. American business people don't want to go to jail, and so it's difficult sometimes to get some of the business. We have, frankly, lost some of the business to Europeans who are better at this sort of thing than we are, to be sure. But trade is expanding now. I think that was then and now is now, and there are some American firms in there that are on the eve of some really sizable projects here. Now, you know, when the Russians invade Georgia and when they attack Shell and they attack ExxonMobil and they attack TNK BP and so forth, you know, it doesn't help Americans to have the rule of law circumvented, you know, directly by the state. The state now in the last 3 to 4 or 5 years in Russia has come back into the economy much more than it was in the early days of the Putin administration. And the state does play an expanding role in the economy, and that's not particularly good. That's not good. And so that has led to a little bit of a leveling off right now. But I think, as I say, to end on an optimistic note, we could be on the eve of a major spurt in our agreement. It will be helpful to have political understanding improved between our two countries. That always helps to have a benign political atmosphere to help the economics.
Let's talk with the caller here in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hi. I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but it seems that, like, when we were mad at the British, the Russians sold us Alaska. And then we made up with the British in the 1890s, and then we invaded Russia after World War One, and have been denying that ever since. And I would be interested in your comments on those things.
Well, it's interesting the historical relationships between U.S. and Russia about invading each other's countries. And sometimes, you know, it's little known to, I think, most Americans, how the Russians in the past have really saved us in many respects here. Start with the American Revolution and our efforts to get away from the British in 1776. King George III asked at that time Alexander II, the Tsar of Russia, to please send 10,000 troops. And the Tsar of Russia said, well, I don't think so. Maybe, you know, 3 or 4 years or so, but not right now. And then more recently in the American Civil War, as you know, the British and the French were ready to intervene on the side of the South. And they asked Russia to join them. And again, Alexander II, I'm sorry, the first Tsar was Catherine the Great in the American Revolution. The second time it was Alexander the Great in 1859, 1860 there, when the South had won a few battles after it started 1861, and they formally asked Alexander II if he would go with them in a coalition to intervene on the side of the South, which actually would have meant that we would have had two countries today. And Alexander II said, I don't think so. And instead of going with the French and the British in this thing, which never occurred, by the way, but you know, it was on the eve of it, and I think the Russians agreed it would have happened, that they would have intervened on the side of the Confederacy. You know, Alexander the Great, II, sent the Russian fleet into New York in a show of force that we are on your side, Mr. Lincoln. And that really helped us out a lot. So, you know, there's this long history of us going back and forth. I mean, I think for the Soviet communists, one of the precipitating factors that turned them against the West so long was, you're exactly right, after the end of World War I, we were part of a major international joint force that invaded Russia up north in Archangel and tried our best to keep the Tsar in power and fight on the side of the White Army against the Red Army, led by Trotsky. And that was a dismal failure. And then I think soured our relationship with Russia for years to come.
Well, I hope that that gets at least in part at the question of the call. Let's go to line number two, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I have a comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
The comment, you mentioned that the Europeans were first off the mark into Russia, and that may or may not well be true. But I would argue that if they were in there, their A-team didn't know a whole lot about Russia. In fact, if you look back 30 years ago, Russian studies, serious Russian studies, really were not pursued very well in Western Europe. Being an expert on Russia was something considered to be either you were pro-communist or anti-communist, but Russia and Eastern Europe as a field for serious study wasn't really off the mark. And what has happened is that some of the European companies that decided to get involved in Russia really wound up hiring American experts in the lead. That's a comment. The other question I have on a more kind of serious vein, the New York Times, you might have seen, had a piece on Russia's support for the Toyota Autovaz factory that produced the Toyota automobile cars. And it said that the efficiency of that car company was astoundingly poor. An average worker could, you know, produce maybe 8 a day compared to the United States, where they can produce 36. That's kind of indicative of the very low quality of productivity in Russia, not to mention the problems of inefficiency of fuel consumption and things of this sort across the board. What really I'd like to know is that when Russia had all this windfall oil profits, what were they doing to try to improve and reverse the tide of their serious economic problems? And it's not just the inefficiency of their industries, it's also their educational system, which has seen a lot of loss, emigration out. It's also the demographic issues, which, as you well know, in 50 years, Russia may be less than 100 million people. Those are some serious long-term issues which will come to haunt them unless they use their current oil wealth, which is depleting kind of rapidly, to do something to reverse this tide. And I'll listen to you.
Well, go ahead.
That's an excellent observation, and frankly, I couldn't agree more about the fact that, and the short answer is that the Russians didn't do enough during the windfall times here high price of crude to start to diversify from crude itself. They laid out a lot of game plans to do so. They're acutely aware of the problem of petrol states and how petrol states spend their money and so forth, and the fact that in many cases petrol states have become economically backward and led to massive corruption and so forth and criminality. They're acutely aware of that, but they haven't done much about it, to be sure. Russia has two enormous problems. Putin has done the first phase of modernization. He's brought political stability to it, and he's organized politics and so forth. And you may not like what he's done there, but it is, you know, the semblance in many respects. And Russia's a lot more free today than it used to be under the Soviets, obviously, and so forth. And he's brought the remnants, or the start, I might say, of a market economy. But that's just the first phase of modernization. There are two enormous areas where the Russians have not moved, and you're exactly right on both of these. One is the fact that they haven't put a lot of money into revitalizing the industrial base of Russia, which is a vast rust belt. a lot of the equipment and machinery that Russians are using out in the countryside are machines that were used before World War II. And that's going to require tremendous amounts of outside investment, because when the price of crude is down, I mean, it certainly can't be funded internally by the Russian government. They've got to have, they must rely, they must attract foreign investment. And now we're talking about just massive amounts of foreign investment to try to transform that industrial base into a modern industrial base. The second thing is they haven't done anything in infrastructure so much. Little things here or there, but they have not used the windfall from oil, as you point out, that they should have. Because, for instance, you know, their highway system is really kind of a joke. Their ports, their railroads, all these kinds of infrastructures that will increase the dynamics of trade, the flow of trade, you know, within Russia, all need to be brought into the 21st century. They're all underfunded, or in some places, non-existent. You know, there may not be a port at all. There may not be a train system where you think it ought to be, and so forth. So that's, again, another huge investment that the Russians need help on to modernize. And if you look at their major resource, which is their people, they haven't done anything in the people infrastructure either. Their healthcare system has totally collapsed, as I think you alluded to. You know, and the population demographics is just plain awful. I was recently at a conference where the minister, where the Russian minister of health, said, "I'm going to be honest with you, everybody, that we've done this major survey of our youth, that 2/3 of Russian children under 16 suffer from, quote, chronic, unquote, illnesses." And then she listed some of those illnesses that she described as chronic, and there's stuff that you and I don't want to have. This is simply appalling, because these people represent the new people that will come into the Russian workforce, and they're all handy. I mean, 2/3 of them come in with a lot of disabilities. And there's no money to pay for it in the healthcare system. It has to be totally recreated. And you point out about the demographics, and you're absolutely correct there, too. Russia is the only country on earth where male life expectancy is fallen. It's now 59. Some people would say it's back up to 61. I don't think so. And there are a huge number of reasons for that, and I won't bore you with all that, which you already know. But that's just an example of the fact that they haven't invested in their people infrastructure. The education system is broken and needs to be fixed. The Russian leadership recognizes this. It's awfully hard to implement it and to get the money going in the right direction. Russia's a big boat, and it takes time to turn it around.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead.
You pointed to the issue of infrastructure, and I wanted to ask you whether you thought that the development of the new areas of oil exploration, which require enormous costs and infrastructure, are worth the effort.
I do. Russia is about the only country on earth I know, and I'm from Oklahoma, and my father was in the oil business, and I know just a tad about it. Not much, but a little bit about it. Russia is the only country I know in the world where proven reserves, not probable reserves or not dubious reserves or possible reserves, proven reserves are increasing every year. Russia has an awful lot of oil. The problem is that the low-hanging fruit, the easy areas there to increase production, have already been done. And the new fields are in tough terrains, off water, you know, off the coast, there in the Arctic and so forth, in the permafrost, where Western oil companies have enormous technical advantages over the Russians. And the Russians know this. They know that they need us to develop these new fields. And in the last 10 years, I'd say almost, there's been very little Russian investment in Russia's oil and gas industry. They really kind of skinned it. They thought that the oligarchs were, you know, getting rich from it and so forth, and they need that money elsewhere. But as a result, they're in a real crisis right now. They're underinvested in petroleum, and they don't, they can't rise to meet the challenge.
I want to thank the caller. We have about 5 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580, talking with Eugene Lawson. He's the founder, former president of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. During the boom time, there was a lot of money coming into the country. I'm thinking of your comments, the question of the caller and your comments about the failure to invest in infrastructure, in people, in the healthcare system, and so forth. That seems to invite the question of where did the money go?
Well, we're kind of asking that about AIG, aren't we?
Well, is that, I mean, did it go into somebody's pocket and then he went out and those people went out and bought stuff for themselves?
And David, let me just tell you a story here. This is one of the anecdotal stories, and take it for what it's worth here. But I have a friend of a friend of a friend who's one of the leading brokers of residential houses on the French Riviera, and his house has started $20 million. And 2 years ago, I guess it was 2007, of the top 20 houses that he sold in value, 18 of them were bought by Russians. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. Of the 18, they're not names that you recognize particularly. They're not the leading oligarchs of Russia. Much of those 18 who bought those houses are mid-level bureaucrats in the Russian government. So the level of corruption has grown, unfortunately. Russia today is more corrupt than she's ever been, and I'm sorry to say that with all my heart. And Medvedev has come into power on a band-aid of trying to correct the corruption, and we all hope that he succeeds in that endeavor. But the fact of the matter is, it's endemic. It's because Putin has expanded it. He's doubled the bureaucracy since he came into power in 2000 as prime minister. He came in 1999, and he's actually doubled the federal bureaucracy. And the rest of the bureaucracy, regional and local levels, have doubled too. And these government bureaucrats feel empowered, and they liberally take, for every dollar that goes there, we'll take a dollar here. And a lot of it has been lost to just straightforward corruption, I'm sorry to say.
I think some people, they look at Russia and the United States, and they say things like, you know, certainly there are things that divide us, and there are issues that are critical to the United States, like Afghanistan and Iran, for example. And those are things that will be difficult. And then they say that there are things, though, that we can actually issues that are important to both, that we can actually agree on and make some progress on. And one example I think people would point to is arms control. So here, you know, we've got issues we can agree on. We have issues that are really tougher. And it seems that the administration is saying they're not saying we shouldn't deal with the tough stuff. But maybe what we should do is put more emphasis on the, you know, start with what we can agree on, and then, you know, to maybe move from the easier to the harder, which would suggest that, you know, if you were going to pick one word, and this is probably overly used when describing the administration, but if you're going to pick one word to describe their approach, it would be pragmatic. If I'm right about that, and you're nodding your head, if that really is one way to describe what it is they're doing, is that a good approach?
Yes, I think it's an awfully good approach here, but I would disagree with you on Iran and Afghanistan. Those are actually two issues that we have a lot in common. At first blush, you might think that we disagree. We actually, David, agree on more than we disagree on both Iran and Afghanistan. You know, the last thing in the world the Russians want is a nuclear-armed Iran on its border. And they want us to succeed in Afghanistan because they want to take some of the pressure off the Muslim extremists here, al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And they have helped us in the past with Afghanistan. So those are two areas, and while the public rhetoric would lead you to believe otherwise, we actually have some huge areas of agreement, and I think Secretary Clinton's going to get on top of that and get into more detail on both of those issues.
The Russians, when there was a Soviet Union, they had this very broad sphere of influence. There was Russia, which was the heartland. There were the republics, which were in effect the first line of defense. There were countries like Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland were important to the Russians for a lot of reasons, but that was one of them. So, and their word for talking about these countries was the near abroad. The idea that was foreign territory, and yet it's our foreign territory. Do you think that are they intent on not necessarily reestablishing the Soviet Union, but continuing to hold on to and perhaps maybe enhance what they have lost since the collapse of the Soviet Union in terms of their sphere of influence?
Well, we ought to make a distinction between the near abroad, which are the former republics of the Soviet Union, and then members of the Warsaw Pact country in Eastern Europe, and so forth. And in Eastern Europe, those countries have really come on strong to be aligned with the U.S. in many respects here. On the near abroad, which is, in fact, Russia's backyard, and, you know, they had a long relationship with it starting in 1923, but even before that, of course, they were dominant here. They are sensitive to that. They saw us as taking sides there in the elections in the Ukraine. They saw what happened in the so-called yellow revolution there in Kyrgyzstan. Acutely aware of when Condi Rice comes to Russia and talk about the need for regime change in Belarus and so forth. You know, all these kind of things reverberate with them. They think, well, is NATO trying to overthrow the Russian government too? You know, they're understandably to some extent paranoid about what we do in those neighboring countries. So I'm kind of sympathetic to their paranoia. We are not about to invade any of those countries, and they are not about to invade and reestablish the Soviet Union, but perception is a lie.
And will, though, this administration, you think, slow down on the idea of NATO expansion?
Yes, I hope so.
Well, there we will have to stop. We are here at the end of the time. Our guest is Eugene Lawson. He is the founder, former president of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, has been an official at the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. and also had posts in the Labor Department and the Commerce Department. He's here visiting the campus. He'll be giving the keynote address for a conference sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, Reform or Retrenchment, Post-Communist Eurasia and the World Economic Crisis. And his talk is Russia, Friend or Foe, this afternoon at 3:15. This is taking place in 210 of the Illini Union, and it's certainly open to anybody who's interested. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for this program comes, in fact, from the Art Mart, and we'll tell you about that.
WILL programs are made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. The Art Mart offers unique items for the home and kitchen, and a deli and bakery featuring Reuben's chocolates. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio.
And right now, we'll take our usual break so we can bring you an update on the markets and also news. In the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the country's leading authorities on walking. We'll talk about how it is a good thing for fitness and what communities can do to make it to make themselves more friendly to walking. That'll be our number two of the show. First, though, we'll take that break, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Prices are well off the highs that they established off of the opening bell. Let's go right ahead to the marketplace, where in Kansas City, May corn is now trading at 577¾, down 2¼. It's been as high as 592 today. July, 586¾, down 3. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 529¼, down 2¾. It's been as high today as 543½. July, 540¾, down 3. May corn, 398¼, up 1¼. It's been as high as 405. July, 407¼, up 1/2. December, 429, up 1¼. May crude oil, 51.06, up 168. May ethanol, 146.8, up 2.8. May soybeans, 1016.5, up 10.5. Its high today is 1030.75. July, 1010.75, up 9.25. August, 984.75, up 7.75. September, 946.25, up 5.25. November, 923.75, up 7.75. The high on the day.